Tonight, we got Beth and Jimmy on, and Jimmy is a former Marine. How you doing, Jimmy?
Pretty good, Michelle.
Doing good. And Beth is a Navy brat. How you doing?
Brady starts in trouble.
Yeah, that's right. Hey,
shenanigans.
I love it that John is so screwed tonight.
I
finally feel blessed that that I don't have a whole bunch of Army people on chewing, you know, getting on me about stuff. So I want to talk a little bit before we get into the story, Jimmy, about what you did in the Marines and where all you've been. I want to talk a little bit about this Monday. We did a show at Ergo Flex, and I want to thank Ergo Flex for allowing us to come on and do it on their location. And I want to give a little bit of a update. You know, my back really isn't bad, you know, wasn't bad. I mean, and it still feels fine. You know, my knee, that was really cool. The knee one, the knee on track, and the back on track were pretty cool. But, man, that total body, it's the oxygen therapy that they did. And I've slept better. My feet hasn't hurt. And, I mean, my cognitive is better. Like, I knew that I drove to work in the last two mornings.
But you're still full of shit, just to be clear.
Well, exactly. I'm always full of shit, so... But I really
failed my people.
Yeah, and you know, we need these machines inside every VA. And so if you watch the podcast, thank you. If you haven't seen it, y'all please go watch it. It's on our Facebook. We're leaving it up. Y'all need to go watch these three things that need to be inside every VA. Now I want to get into the fun part, Jimmy. I want you to tell us about your time in the Marines.
Which part?
The year. I want to know the year you went in, where all you went.
I shouldn't say that. I don't even know, okay?
I'll skip some of it because you've been in the Navy. You, I'm sure, realize that what happens on ship stays on ship.
Yes, yes.
What happens on boat stays on boat. I joined the Corps in 97, pre-war and all that. Did boot camp Parasite, went to Camp Geiger, which is next to Camp Lejeune there in North Carolina, and then was stationed out in Camp Pendleton basically for the rest of my career, or up until I got hit as far as it goes. But I was in 2nd Training, 1st Marines for 4 years. Did 2 SFACs on a USS Boxer and spent 2 years at Edson Range as a range coach, teaching recruits how to shoot, which was a really fun job because you got to shoot every day, but you never actually had to clean a weapon.
What? Yeah, how the hell did you manage that?
take the recruit's weapon, take this extra rounds that they didn't get fired off, shoot them off and give the recruit back your weapon and they get to clean it at night. So,
okay.
it was a great job.
Well, they weren't going to let me do anything like that in the Navy. I mean, they wouldn't even let me press buttons because I'm telling you, I would have been like, what the hell does this red one says? Do not touch.
This one shines pretty.
And then, in January of 2004, I checked into 2nd Battalion, 4th Marines. February of 2004, we flew out. Was in Kuwait for 2 weeks, finishing off training and acclimatizing. And then flew into Ramadi, Iraq. We were in a combat outpost in Ramadi. Most of our missions were either MSR patrols looking for IEDs are just clearing the supply routes and stuff, and then patrolling the area to quote unquote keep us safe, kind of like policing actions, I guess. We did do quite a few planned coordinate knocks. Usually it Zero Dark Thirty. As far as that goes, which is quarter knocks are your low intensity raids, where you knock on the door and ask if you can come in and search because of this, that, and the other. It really doesn't matter what to say. You're going to go in and search anyway, but you give them the courtesy and whatnot. And then on May 29th, when I went over, I was a section leader due to casualties that sustained early on. My platoon commander became the XO. My staff sergeant became the platoon commander, and I ended up becoming the interim platoon sergeant for a while, and went out one of the squads on a foot patrol doing what they called an IO mission, which was handing out soccer balls or coloring books to kids and pamphlets to the adults saying if they knew of insurgent or Mujahideen activities in the area, call these numbers or follow these steps and stuff. We had a new translator for our company that was out with us that day, and we started talking to this kid who may have been 12. He started telling us about his uncle and his uncle's friends liking to attack U.S. troops in the area. And the stuff he was describing via the translator kind of sounded like scenes coming out of Black Hawk Down, shooting rockets at helicopters and attacking U.S. forces or whatever, as far as it goes. And so we followed the kid to the uncle's house, called the QRF out, but it took them, almost an hour to get to us because the routes to us were closed off temporarily for other possible IED. DOD had the routes closed off because of possible IED threats. And while we were waiting on QRF, we were talking to the uncle outside his house. And in the first 5 minutes, he changed the story five times between it wasn't his nephew, it was his nephew, but he was diagnosed as being crazy or whatever. They had doctor's notes and chronic liar, this, that, and the other. Kept trying to get the kid, we wouldn't let him. QRF gets out there. We ended up searching the house, found a couple weapons. Nothing major as far as it goes, but he said he didn't have anything. And due to all the changes in the story, the fact that he had stuff and didn't admit it, and everything, we decided to detain him and take him back to base. Our 3-hour foot patrol had become a 6-hour op at this point, and it was like 125 that day. So I made the call. We jumped in QRS vehicles to catch a ride back, and I got to count for all the vehicles, gave it to the QRF commander, jumped in the last vehicle, and we took off. And as we rounded the last corner onto the main road, we were about 2 clicks from the combat outpost. As my vehicle rounded the corner, someone pushed a button, blew up a station wagon packed full of C4 Boeings. I lost 4 of my Marines that day. I took traumatic injury to the leg, was blown out of the vehicle, had a nice bump to the back of the head.
Is that what we're calling it?
Yeah.
Okay.
I ended up getting medevaced out. They drug induced me into a coma in Baghdad. I was still in a coma for like a week in Longstroll. And then they flew me back to the States to Bethesda, at the time it was Bethesda Naval Medical Center.
The real Bethesda. You know what I'm talking about, Navy, right?
That's right.
It's not Walter Reed. It'll never be Walter Reed. They tore Walter Reed down. It's Bethesda.
Exactly.
Oh, Bethesda. Okay, okay.
And so when they flew you back, they flew you over to the main Navy hospital and started working on you And I mean, but in the meantime, you know, at that time, they put you in a induced coma. Is that so that way you wouldn't feel your pain? You wouldn't know what's going on? Is that why they did that?
So your body can heal. So they can give you medicine, because generally if you're awake, that's energy you're burning. And these guys come back with, like, they're a shell of a person. Oh, sorry. They're a shell of a person. So it's the way to get back their health faster than shorter.
And when I first got Bethesda in 04, at that point in time, I'm going to guess they probably had worse since, but at that point in time, I was the worst case of infection in the hospital I'd ever seen. They were doing 1 to 2 washouts a day on my leg. But the infection still got so bad that it was lose my leg or lose my life. They finally ended up taking the leg.
His mom didn't want to make that decision. I think as any parent or spouse, you know, hearing that kind of news, not knowing that person's reaction, you know, it's a hard decision. It's a hard choice to be made.
Yeah.
Yeah. And woke up in Bethesda, was awake there for maybe 3 days before they transferred me to Walter Reed, since that's where all the amputees were going at the time. And that's where I ended up actually retiring out of. Almost 3 years later.
You were there 3 years.
That was our first round.
Yeah.
What?
That was the first round.
Yeah. We've had a couple rounds at Walter Reed, and they've never been shorter than 2 years. We actually ended up moving to Maryland. It was just easier.
Okay. Yeah. So wait. Hold on. But when did y'all meet?
I was just getting ready to say.
Yeah.
Reasons, being an amputee, being deaf in the left, on my left ear, and everything else that's going on as far as it goes, getting blown up for obvious reasons was the worst physical thing that ever happened to me. But it was also the best thing that ever happened to me. If I wouldn't have been blown up, I wouldn't have been at Walter Reed. If I wouldn't have been at Walter Reed, I wouldn't have met Beth. She was a USO volunteer. If I wouldn't have met Beth, we wouldn't have three beautiful kids. So I like to say that everything happens for a reason. Sometimes you just have to wait and see what it is.
Hmm. I had gone through a few things. My mom was sick. She passed away from cancer, and she actually had a couple different types of cancer, from bone cancer to breast cancer and ovarian cancer. And so over 9 years, from 15 to 24, that's all I knew, was to be a caretaker. And when she passed away, personally, I was not doing well. And, you know, I struggled a lot with her death, and I went back to what I knew, and what I knew was supporting our veterans. So at that time, it was 2004, a lot was going on. My friends who, you know, had got out of high school were in the military. My brother was in the military. So I just went back to my roots, and I realized I needed to think about somebody other than myself. So that's what started me volunteering at Walter Reed.
That's badass. Yeah,
that's how we met.
That is awesome.
I don't care what anybody says. That's that to me. That takes a lot of guts. Somebody who will volunteer for veterans. Yeah, you're in my good book.
Thank you so much. I know. You know, obviously, any veteran. You know, but volunteering in it. You know that I've not in a hospital sense, but volunteering. I do some of it, but not in the hospitals. That takes, I don't even know how to phrase it, because you see a lot of unpleasant stuff, you know?
Yeah, you do.
But, so I got to go back, Jimmy, because here again, like I talked to y'all last night briefly and explained, I just will tell you, I don't know shit about what happened with you guys. I'm going to call spade a spade. So I was joking around, yes and no, kind of, sort of. But in our when I say our war in the 1991 and the Gulf War, we kind of, for the lack of a better way to phrase it, kind of pissed that region off, right? We kind of pissed them off. And you know, years later, you guys, you know, for over 20 years, you guys were there. Now, when you tell me QRF took almost an hour, so I'm an Army guy, you're Marine, Kevin Navy, and when I think QRF, quick reactionary force. Why the bloody hell? A, why was, didn't they? I think of that if they can't, because you said DOD had roads closed off. So why weren't there helicopters en route, you know, or something like that? I'm a little confused by that. Where was that at?
What were you, Army?
Yeah, you know, Army.
They don't get all that stuff. What are you talking about?
You know, they get the luxury stuff. And you're asking a Marine why it took so long.
When I first got in country,
yeah,
we had you know, the high back Hummers. You know, they'd taken the soft top off, and we had plywood and sandbags as armor. And when I first got there, we actually went to the Army base and had it motor tea, and actually it might have been it was you guys, the motor tea and the engineers over there took 3/8 inch thick sheet metal and welded walls on the side across the benches and across the bed of the truck, and then actually made us little pass doors for the driver and a driver as well, so they would have some sort of armor.
And your section leader made chaps like,
yeah, my company Gunny,
sorry.
On the newer black jackets that we had with the body system and everything, they came with these shoulder pieces that would hang a little ways down your arm, but it just like snapped in, and they'd flop around a bit, and with extra weight held extra heat in. So a lot of guys, most of us, took them off and left them in supply. And there was also a cod piece that we'll say that gotten away too much as far as that goes. Yes, it would have been a little bit of protection, but the lack of maneuverability when you have it on is kind of ridiculous as far as that goes. So again, but no one actually clipped that piece in either. So our company Gunny, he took the shoulder pads and cod pieces, and actually made, he found a way to stitch them to the seams together. And he made basically Kevlar chaps.
Really?
For the machine gunners to wear when they were standing behind the vehicles in these open top Hummers, so that at least they had some sort of leg protection.
Wow. Wait a second. So wait, you said fucking chaps. I mean, okay.
Have you ever rode a horse?
Yeah, okay. Machine gun position. What's that?
We kept our camis on. They weren't assless.
It wasn't like Magic Mike.
That much. What?
It wasn't like Magic Mike.
You never know.
Yeah, well, that you are dealing with Marines there. That you never know.
Yeah. Well, you know, and I remember. See, when we were in you know, back in 1991, we were welding shit on for, you know, for the tanks and whatnot on the front to clear mines. And you're saying you're still are doing that sort of shit in 2004?
Yes.
Because now they got my vehicle.
Like a lot of people were talking about, oh, the upper armored Hummers, this, that, and the other. We didn't have those when I got there. The vehicle I was in, luckily enough, had just gotten an upper armored windshield delivered and installed the day before. It was the only thing that saved the A driver's life. He had a minor concussion, some scrapes and bruises, because the blast itself blew him out of the passenger seat bodily onto the driver. But the upper armor windshield stopped so much of the shrapnel that it literally saved his life. But wow. That was the only quote unquote actual armor that the vehicle had. The rest of it was, like I said, 3/8 inch thick sheet metal, which would deflect a lot of shrapnel and would stop a 7.62 unless it was like an exact straight on shot that those could punch through. But the one issue that we had, because you're running desert areas, so you're running with the tires at only half inflation or whatever, you know, they let some of the air out so that when you're going through the soft sand and everything, you get better traction, you'll be stuck. And the extra weight of all that sheet metal was starting to burn the transmissions out.
Oh, damn. Okay. All right.
And ladies and gentlemen, this is why Kevin Simon decided to join the Navy. I just want that to be known. I would have not have made a good Marine or an Army guy. I'm just telling y'all. What he went through, though, is something that is, to me, it's a part of when you're at war, everyday military life. I mean, your guys saved your life. I mean, out on the battlefield, you guys know, y'all know what to do. You know, quick reaction. As long as everybody don't panic and y'all are calm, y'all got shit done because you're still around. And I mean, that,
yes,
I mean, it is true. And that's what I give a lot of the reasons why when we go into the military, they drill you, pound in your head exactly what you need to do in case something like this happens. And so kudos to everybody who was able to get you out. And for the ones who didn't make it home, I thank them with everything I have. Because
at the time he was injured, was the unit taking the most casualties at that point?
Yeah. At the time I was injured, and
because they were being in Ramadi, being in one of the hottest areas, as far as action,
I think it may even still hold to an extent. My unit took the most combat casualties, either wounded or killed in action, for a company-sized unit since the Vietnam War.
Yeah, wow. They're having their 20-year anniversary this April. Unfortunately, we can't make it out to California. It's too expensive nowadays, but,
it is a bit pricey.
They all keep in touch, I've been a military brat my whole life, obviously, and been around and involved in the military. One thing I can say about the Marines, there's a brotherhood there that I don't normally see. Not that it's not existent in the other ones, but there's just something different. Not only with the way being at Walter Reed, checking on their guys, coming to visit, flying in from California, somebody from his unit on a regular. I didn't see that in the Army. I didn't see that as much, in the Navy as well. It was something that,
I admire that. You're right. Now when y'all got married and, I'm sure you did most of talking for him.
The doctors looked at me. They're like, "How are you doing?"
Yeah, because I mean, most guys don't know how to talk for themselves. Honestly, when they're in a hospital, that's why we get married, because our wives will tell them exactly how we're feeling, exactly what we're doing. And I'm telling you. What 6 months ago, whenever I thought about committing suicide because they messed up on my medicine. The first thing my wife says to me is, whatever you do, do not get mad. It's not the doctor's fault that they messed up on. Not these doctors' fault that they messed up. We get in there and she starts yelling at them. And I didn't have to say shit. Yeah.
It's hard for me to speak up for myself. So it's really strange because, we have been together for almost 20 years. We're celebrating our 20-year anniversary this year. And, I've had breast cancer. I've, battled that for 13 years. And he's had to take care of me in just the same manner that I've taken care of him. And as somebody walking into this situation, I literally asked myself, will he take care of me the way I'm taking care of him? And he definitely surprised me. Like, he was always my biggest cheerleader and my biggest advocate when I did it for myself.
That's badass.
So it's very normal for our spouse to kind of take on that role.
Yeah, my wife tells me I'm the worst nurse ever. That's because she's the nurse. I'm not, you know.
My wife's a phenomenal caretaker, but
we spend at the hospital, but we don't.
Yeah.
My wife is a wonderful caretaker. She is her own. I mean, as far as her being, you know, she's having some issues. She just went through a couple of small procedures with her feet, and she is she's got, most of you women got stupid high pain tolerances.
I don't
get that pain tolerance. I'm like, I get a headache, I'm like, give me a freaking aspirin now. You know, I have no pain tolerance. But she's like her own worst. She's like her own worst patient. She is a terrible patient.
Well, you know,
taking care of others, great.
For 3 months with a broken hip because it was too inconvenient to go get a CT scan because I had to deal with
what?
I was on crutches for 3 months before they diagnosed I had a hip.
Three freaking months.
No freaking way, man. I get a stubbed toe and I cry. I'm honest.
It wasn't affected. No one thought that would have been a thing for the way she got hurt because it was completely shy. There was no impact. There was no fall. It was actually quite the opposite. She was jumping up and something happened as far as that goes. So the doctors were like, oh, it must be a pulled muscle. And then when it wasn't getting any better, well, you must have tore something. And it's like, well, we need to get you a CT scan. And she just like, yeah, I'll get there sometime.
Well, you know.
Wow.
You know.
And finally we get her in there and it was taking forever.
Golly.
They come out and they're like, we're sorry it's taking so long. We're trying to get a hold of the doctor to figure out what they want to do. You don't have a torn muscle. You have a broken hip.
I have a fractured femur. And
oh,
I need to go to the hospital immediately for surgery. And they put all equipment. I ended up getting a hip replacement eventually because it didn't work too well with them trying to put it together. But, yeah, I have a pretty high pain tolerance.
Yeah, it sounds like to me you got more than a high pain tolerance.
That's some extra... You're immortal bullshit right there. I don't pay a freaking broken hip for God's sake. Holy shit.
So since you've been out, this is
my son's birth story.
Oh no, thank God. Thank God.
But...
thank God. So since you've been out, you know, do y'all deal with the VA or do y'all deal with outside doctors?
We do both. I've also, you know, worked and volunteer. I volunteer with the Red Cross. I was working for a veterans charity organization, and now I volunteer for two others. And, you know, that's where I spend my time because I really believe in veteran-run organizations. But as far as medical care, we've always done both. Like, we've done a little bit here at the VA and a little bit here at, like, the military hospital. We're just, for the first time, starting to enroll in regular health care, like, you know, regular doctors. And we did it for a little bit in Texas. We were also lucky. We had a wonderful doctor who did a lot of study on PTSD, on, you know, testosterone and how... produced more testosterone than most guys with all of the impact and energy stuff.
All the high impact and high adrenaline stuff that we're doing is that veterans are doing, whether it be in training or in combat or both, as far as it goes, we generally have a tendency to run at higher levels of testosterone on the higher end. And then when we get out, generally you don't have a job that is as fast paced or high stress and everything else as far as it goes. So, and then also with getting older, your testosterone levels drop.
And that ends up affecting your PTSD, your TBI. Your overall mental health. You know, Jimmy didn't really have any real PTSD because he doesn't remember what happened. Okay. Like, there's up to an hour before and after. He doesn't remember, but he's been told everything. So it's kind of like when your parents tell you the same story, you kind of create that memory in your head. But one of the guys that passed away found out he was going to be a dad the day before.
Oh, man.
Had testicular cancer in 02 and was told he'd never have children. So when we got pregnant with our first child, it really messed with him because he felt like he stole someone's life. That this was somebody else's story and he's somehow miraculous. It was a lot of survivor's guilt. And I don't think people realize how big and how much that affects your life on your day-to-day, you know.
And I'm glad you're bringing that up. I'm glad you're bringing that up because that's really hardly ever talked about, survivor guilt. But here's one thing about it, though, Jimmy, is I remember I was talking to a guy, and he has survivor guilt for what he went through, lost his best friend, and then also lost his, you know, so many other guys in his unit that when he started going to church and he was dealing with a veteran, they're outside veterans psychiatric centers. One of the things that his psychiatrist told him is, and I think it's one of the best things that ever can be told, God does this for a reason. And that's how you have to look at it, you know, and that's great, you know, but survival guilt is a big thing. And, I don't know about it, much about it, but I do know that it's, to me, worse than PTSD. I really do.
I think with those things combined, and the older that you get, these things deteriorate. Your TBI gets worse. Your PTSD can get worse. And, you know, we were talking, you know, you had brought up, you know, you feeling suicidal, you know, never thought that's something that Jimmy may feel, but he has gotten there. And it's medication changes. It's not getting your meds when you have to transfer. Having to constantly go to this, to a new doctor every 3 months and relive your story. You know, that's where I'm finding a lot of complaints and issues with the VA is the consistency of the healthcare, the consistency of healthcare. This is the consistency of mental health. You know, my brother, like I said, you know, had committed suicide, you know, because of his man beliefs that he shouldn't get help and that, you know, what's kind of ingrained in, especially guys like you in the Gulf War and kind of up towards where Jimmy was, you don't talk about it. You don't tell people you have PTSD because then you lose your job or then they push you out.
Yeah. The PTSD, I know for myself, you know, I would not talk about that because a lot of people, you bring it up and you start talking about it, and you can almost see them putting a title or see their mood change in like, oh, well, poor, they don't understand it. They don't, so they're not dealing with themselves. And it's like, they almost like label you. Do you feel yourself doing this a lot, Jimmy? You know, a lot of ups and downs throughout life?
Yeah, definitely. That's where it goes. Like I said, as far as the PTSD, and it's both of you said, you know, it's one of those things where for the longest time, most of us didn't talk about it, even if you did recognize it, you had it. If you could avoid it, you didn't, because there was such a stigma or stereotype or both. Those four letters.
But
yeah, it was like, don't tell anybody you've got PTSD. You won't be able to own a gun. You won't be able to do this. You won't be able to get a federal job, blah, blah, blah. None of that stuff was actually the case for 90% of people who do have PTSD.
Right.
More.
That's right. And on top of that
stigma and stereotype where, oh, you know, he's got PTSD. You watch out. He's going to, you know, be digging bunkers and foxholes in his front yard or backyard and sit, you know, barricade himself in, and this, that, and the other. And there's, it's not always the case.
There's
rarely
levels, the case, actually. There's such levels of degrees with PTSD, and even like if you talk about bipolar, there's such level, you know, different degrees that, but when you say those two things, PTSD and or bipolar, people assume the worst. And I mean,
but the worst part,
we've even been approached by our son. Obviously we didn't meet till after he was injured. Our son wasn't born and this is all he's ever known. And we were called into a guidance counselor's office, somebody who should be educated in this area of some form. Like, I'm not, she works with children, so it's not, you know, a large education that she has to have, but you'd think she'd have some. She's like, I think that your son is suffering from, or having a hard time dealing with your injury. We're like, why would you say that? She goes, he doesn't ever talk about it.
Oh, son of a...
Why would he talk about it? What am I going to tell a five-year-old?
Right.
Right.
Daddy. Like...
My family did not know anything until they were 20.
It was 8 years since my injury. Do the math.
God, that is so stupid. That is the dumbest thing. But, I mean, like, y'all were talking about how people put labels on things. But... it isn't just outside people, because a lot of outside people who've never been in the military, it don't understand. And I know that.
But we the do VA, this
out. Right, but the VA doesn't understand it neither. Because, like, I went in, and I went in for tremors, and my tremors got worse and worse, and they had me on medicine. The first thing he said is, it's all inside your head. And he put that in my record.
He's done that and refuses to go to the healthcare because they were told the same thing. And he's in a wheelchair. And telling the wife, you want him in the wheelchair. What do you mean she wants him in a wheelchair? You know how complicated that is? I traveled with them a couple weekends ago. We're never all flying again.
Golly.
I mean, but somebody who's supposed to be educated. And that's the problem I think I find the most with VA. Like, I love, like, for instance, the caregiver program. It opened up to pre-9/11. The problem with that is they didn't open up their budget. They kept their budget close to almost the exact same, but want to take in two times the amount of people. 100% pre-9/11 deserves to have the caregiver program, because those are the ones who are needing it the most and going into that age group.
So let me interrupt you a second, Beth. I got a question. I had a sibling ask me today, as a matter of fact, and I thought it was kind of off the wall, or not off the wall, but an odd question. I'm like, so humor me, if I don't know if you're receiving it or not, because the vast majority of us, I don't know, some have caregivers and some don't. You can get, it was, do they refer to it as a stipend?
Yeah. What happens is you have to, and let me tell you, applying for the, I'm not on it, because he's not injured enough. He's not in a bed, is pretty much what they told us. His PTSD is not high enough. They ask you trick questions like, how's your sex life? And you say, well, it's not that great. Now, it could be not that great just because of 100 other things. You know, the medications they're on, whatever. That automatically makes them disqualify you because you're a burnt out caregiver. How can you continue? They ask these trick questions to almost purposely fail you. Then you fail. And just like most claims, they'll deny it because they're waiting for those people who don't reapply. My suggestion always is to reapply. Don't take the first denial. But the caregiver program, it is a great program. It's just not funded properly to take on all of these veterans.
I agree.
Which 100%. Don't, when I say this, please don't get me wrong. You guys deserve it. Pre-9/11 deserves it. We just didn't budget properly to open it up because now 9/11 people are getting kicked out. People who've been in the program since the beginning. I know a triple amputee whose wife got kicked out.
What?
Now she does some work.
See,
it's just it's very gray in so many areas. It's not black and white for us, and it needs to be black and white. That's how our mentality is when it comes to procedures. We want it done. And they just don't do that. And it depends on what that particular person who's writing in your chart feels at that particular moment.
There you go. Thank you. You're the first guest I've ever had on that said that. It's it's exactly what they perceive of what you say is what you put in the notes. And that's why you better be very careful about what you say. And
you have to be careful what you say. And you always want to ask for your records. You always want to ask for notes. You want to be over their shoulder while they're typing those notes in. That's my suggestion to caregivers, because if you go back in like 5 years and you have to prove that this injury is caused from this, those notes are invaluable and almost can give you, you know, the benefits you deserve or deny you the benefits you deserve.
Well, I honestly believe anybody that has amputee, they should automatically get 100%, and their spouse should get 100%. Automatically.
Yeah. The other funny part, like you said, it is what they consider, or the trick questions of a sort, or whatever as far as that goes, or the things that they take off the consideration, or take off the board for consideration as far as becoming a caregiver, is, well, those are wifely duties.
Yes.
That was not the thing we were told.
What?
What?
Those were my wifely duties.
Basically, with a snap.
Which I did. I walked in, and I'm different. And I have the utmost respect for the wives that kissed their husbands goodbye and stayed at home and prayed,
yes,
you know, to not get that phone call. I still get tears in my eyes when I think about his mother getting that phone call. But, you know, I knew what I was walking into. I knew the level of care that I was going to have to give. Maybe not to the full extent, not thinking about 20 years down the road when things start breaking down. But at the moment, I did know what I was getting into. There's a lot of wives, you know, who didn't sign up for this. But they're sticking in there and they're staying in there. And they just need... I get angry because you guys took a pledge to our country to sacrifice yourself for us. And we took a pledge to you in return to take care of you. And we are not, as Americans, keeping our promise. We always ask, well, why do you expect to get this? Why do you, just because you're a veteran, do you expect to get this? Because that's what happened. We, you know, they went over there, you guys went over there, and of course you should be taken care of.
You know what makes me the angriest, though, is seeing the elderly guys that went over there and fought, and then they're barely making ends meet. And they get told you make too much money.
I fought for benefits as a family of $50,000 a year. It's too much money.
Right. And I mean, one of my uncles had to divorce his wife in order to get care. Well, what happens whenever you divorce your wife? Your wife does not get any of the benefits. And so this is where my anger issue comes in. I don't have PTSD. I never had PTSD. But I do have what's called anger manage problems when it comes to shit like that. Because why should the spouse have to suffer along with the husband, and you're making them get divorced, but she's still going to take care of them because your ass ain't going to take care of them.
And I know couples who have divorced because their marriage didn't work, and they're still taking care of their husbands.
Yes.
Because the VA is not coming in and helping him when he's, you know, life happens, you know?
I think they're totally messed up. We are now getting to the end of the program, though. But please tell your YouTube channel.
We don't have a YouTube channel. We are looking at doing a show with another one of our admins.
Okay.
But we do have a group. It's called Crayon Eater's Wife 1775. And it's a really, I got tired of being in a community that tore each other down. I got tired of being part of a community that people made money off of our backs, off of our stories. So it was funny. We started this as just a joke to kind of highlight our life. And it just spiraled. But it spiraled in such a wonderful way because, like I said, at that moment, I was ready to walk away from the veteran community.
Right. Unfortunately, unfortunately, there are a lot of veteran communities that have become or just are toxic.
They are.
Unfortunately, a lot of veterans or veteran families in one way, shape, or form have developed talking bad about each other in one way, shape, or form, or trying to talk bad about someone else that's a veteran to other people so that they don't get ahead. Or
it's all a survivor in some senses.
Veterans hoarding resources that they know about instead of openly sharing them so that all veterans can take advantage of or not take advantage.
And that's true. That's a lot of
resources that are out there, but there are unfortunately a lot of communities where the resources aren't being shared. And that was one of our goals, was to be a community that supports and hey, if you're having an issue, say something. If you don't want to post it, message one of us or whatever as far as it goes, and we will help you find the resources you need to keep your head above water.
Because
there are a lot of resources, and like you guys are saying, I do get very frustrated with there are a lot, Jimmy, as you're saying, and Beth both, there are a lot of organizations who will go nameless, and some people, how can I get put ahead because I'm a veteran and I have this secret information that can make you be a higher rate if you're not 100%, or I can for a monetary amount of money I can tell you what you need to do to get this down. I'm like,
I'm with you. That's that. I agree, John.
The information is there. It's called share it so we know where to go. It's not a freaking secret. Be honest and open about things. I mean, we all need to make a living, but it's when like Beth, like you were saying earlier, just take care of us. The politicians in our world, they tell us everything. They tell our American citizens what they know they want the American citizens to hear about the veterans, but when it comes right down to it, do they actually support it? And they're not supporting when it comes time.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly.
Exactly. When it's convenient for them, I'm like, no.
I want to talk about that. I want to talk about that after the show, John. I want to talk about that after the show.
Okay.
But it's time. Right. And I want to thank everybody for listening. Beth and Jimmy, please hang on.
Thank you for having me. I'm so happy you guys did that. This was really fun.
Well, we're going to do
it.
I want y'all to stay on. We do what's called a little after show. We kind of get into something a little bit deeper. But I want to thank for everybody listening. Y'all go to the YouTube page, like and share. We're trying to grow it up. We're trying to get the word out there. And veterans, get along. And everybody, God bless. Thank you very much.